Dr. Peter Kapsner has returned. He has not just returned to the show. He has returned from across the pond. So welcome back, sir.
Thanks, Carmen. Great to be back in the morning here with you and Paul.
We're glad to have you back with us. Okay, so I would like to talk with you this morning about this article I just read yesterday at the Religion News Service. So if folks want to find it, it's at religionnews.com. The headline is, Christian Higher Ed Can't Win the LGBTQ Debate Unless It Transforms. So I really kind of want to walk through this piece with you, but let's just get your initial reaction. You know, because there's a lot of folks that only read headlines.
Right.
And so if you only read the headline, Christian Higher Ed Can't Win the LGBTQ Debate Unless It Transforms, what are you left with?
Yeah, you're left with the idea that basically they're going to be left behind in sort of the cultural tsunami sweep of LGBTQ conversation, where it's pretty clear where we're headed as a country from a secularized standpoint, and that's the increasing embrace of multiple gender identification, multiple ways in which you identify yourself from an attraction standpoint, whether gay or lesbian. That already has sort of swept over us, and now we're just living within kind of the next generation of it. And what we're seeing, Carmen, in reference to that article, is sort of the first crop of young people over the last 5, 6, 7 years in which they have been specifically educated quite intentionally in many of our public and some of our private schools as well around how to be a safe person with LGBTQ and how to understand the situation, how to fight for justice on behalf of. And these kids, many of whom are believers, are really taking their cues from what's going on in the schools and among their friends and among some of maybe the blogs that they read. And there's been a relative absence of a pretty sophisticated response from the church on these issues. So there's not a contrast. There's not a dissenting voice necessarily that's helping empower and equip them in a different way. And so now these young people, when they turn 18, 19, 20, are showing up at the doors of some of our pretty highly regarded academic Christian institutions around the country. And they are coming in with a worldview that assumes an embrace of LGBTQ issues and the social justice therein. And they're often greeted with that institution's historic stance that says, we don't embrace all of these issues. We don't hold to same gender marriage. We don't believe in gender blurring. But even sometimes these institutions are not really offering a very sophisticated or complex response as to why. Even something as simple as saying, well, the Bible says that this is the way marriage should be. Sometimes institutions don't understand that there's many churches out there that are saying, hey, our reading of scripture does allow for a same gender marriage and some of where our culture is. And so these students showing up at the doors of the institutions have an assumed worldview. The institutions don't have a terribly robust response as of yet. And so the students are very much, as you referenced in the tease to all of this, putting a lot of pressure on a lot of conservative institutions to begin to change their points of view. And I think the last part of that, Carmen, before we dig in a little bit more deeply, the importance of that is that academic institutions drive what happens in our churches. And what I mean by that is pastors are trained in our Christian ministry programs, whether at the undergraduate level or the seminary level. And if they're not being trained and equipped to handle these kind of conversations, then it's going to continue to be something that is silent in the church, and the tsunami will keep sweeping over us. So it's a pretty big deal right now. What we hear going on in churches is almost always a direct result of the equipping of pastors in the institutions. And if the institutions are changing their views on these, well, there's not many people left then to have a different kind of voice.
So the challenges that David Gushee points out in this piece are legitimate. There is this legitimate contest, maybe is the best way to describe it. And he really describes it, one, as the irresistible force, and that would be the cultural movement in the direction of LGBTQ, not only acceptance, but destigmatizing of all things LGBTQ and whatever other letters may be attached to that as well. He views that as the irresistible force. And then he describes as the immovable object what I would say is traditional Christian teaching.
Right.
And if the immovable object is then to be moved in order that it survive, it doesn't survive because it has moved. Like, his argument is that the institutions must change in order for the institutions to continue to survive in a culture that's changing. But if those institutions, because they're Christian, authentically Christian, distinctively Christian, really Christian, if they change in these ways, they cease to be what they were and they die anyway. I mean, they may survive in form, but they totally fail in function.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Carmen. When a university or a traditional historic conservative Christian academic institution decides to shift and just goes along with the culture, there's no distinctive part anymore. There's no reason really to attend. But on the flip side of it, the pressure that an institution might face is that as young people increasingly are being sort of indoctrinated or taught a different understanding of historic sexuality, they may not want to go to an institution that is saying otherwise. And as we know, academic institutions are dependent upon tuition fee-paying students, typically, unless they have a very large donation base in that. And so there's a lot of pressure in the face of dropping enrollment to wonder about historic positions with this. And there really doesn't seem to be a win for the institutions, the academic ones, if they just go along with it, as you referenced. And there may not be a win if they try to put their stake in the ground on these issues as well, because a lot of young people will say, well, I don't want to necessarily go there. I do think, Carmen, there's a third way. And that third way is that to the institution that decides to maybe not just have a class on sexuality or may not just approach it in chapel like once a year or something along those lines, but really wants to build out a robust infrastructure in terms of the response to all of this, I think there's going to be a lot of Christian families who would be very, very hungry and very interested in sending their children to an institution that really has a much more sophisticated response to help equip our young people. And I say that just based on the microcosm of my sexuality class that I've taught these last probably 10 years or so. We are right in the middle, and in about an hour and a half, we'll dive into it again in my class on Wednesday morning. We're right in the middle of addressing the whole LGBTQ conversation. And Carmen, it takes me maybe 15 hours in class, and that is just a starting point to sort of go through the scriptural views, to go through some of the tradition and the history, to go through the biology and the sciences, world experience, all of that. And again, it's just a starting point. I would probably need somewhere between 40 and 60 hours to really do what's required to equip young people on these conversations. And that's based on, it took me 3 years of my own research to try to get my head around what's going on. So there is a third way besides just acquiescing or putting your flag on the ground. It really is a much more sophisticated response that's needed.
Okay, when we come back, I actually want to kind of stick with this this subject, but also expand the conversation because I do think there is this genuine question about how religion, specifically traditional Christianity, confessional Christianity, is or is not attractive, maybe, is a word that we would use to the next generation, to young people. And so I want to continue this conversation, Peter, but I also want to sort of add the other portion of the conversation to it, which is this attempt to make Christianity attractive by making it less distinctively Christian.
Yeah.
And so that conversation is the one that Peter Kapsner and I will continue to have when we come back. Continuing my conversation with Dr. Peter Kapsner. So, Peter, one of the things that I would say is maybe the bottom line of this David Gushy piece posted at religionnews.com, Christian higher ed can't win the LGBTQ debate unless it transforms. The bottom line for me is this. Ultimately, and this is a quote from the piece, and when he says most here, he's talking about the LGBTQ students and their allies. Ultimately, most want Christian colleges and seminaries to abandon traditionalist Christian teaching that harms them deeply. So I want to talk about the harm language. I want to talk about the power of harm language. And then I want to talk about the reality that, you know, Christianity and is not harmful. It's helpful.
Yeah. Yeah. This is when something gets twisted and right, you know, flying upside down, isn't it? And if we think of Satan as the father of all lies, as the biblical text refers to him to be, then we sort of have to be suspicious of anything that starts going mainstream and starts getting sort of a herd mentality around it, including this harm language where it's actually been flipped entirely upside down. And Carmen, I think, you know, Satan shows up in the text in a couple of ways. One is as a roaring lion, and I know what to do if I see a roaring lion, I run. But it's Satan as an angel of light that I think is the more troubling version of sort of the darkness that's around us, because an angel of light looks great and beckons you towards it, thinking that you're going to experience hope and healing and health and peace and all of that, when actually you are going to be experiencing destruction. And so all of the invitations of our culture right now, as the tsunami has swept over us, is that if you can just find your identity, if you can just be free to pursue your attraction, if you can just all of these sorts of things, that that's where all of your help and healing is going to be. And by contrast, the beauty and wonder of what male and female relationships are supposed to be, according to historic church teaching, that's seen as harm. Carmen, that's the exact opposite of what it is that it's meant to be. And so I think there is some opportunity here, again, as I referenced, for churches and for institutions to sort of reestablish the idea of what is the beauty and the wonder and the help and the wholeness and healing that is our image-bearing reality as young men and young women, as in our marriages and our sexuality. What is that? Because in God's kingdom, there will be peace and there will be shalom and there will be help and healing. The harm actually comes by untethering from all of that and deciding to pursue your own sense of sexuality in a variety of ways. And the last piece that I can say about it is in chapel a couple of weeks ago here at Northwestern. And I know our young people pretty well here at Northwestern just based on the papers that they turn in and what they communicate to me in classes. And they are very confused and they're hurt and they've often run through a lot of boundaries in their sexuality. And in God's kingdom, we judge things by the fruit, by what is born into the future. And so whatever it is we have been teaching and whatever it is they have been listening to in our education system is bearing the fruit, as it were, of pain, confusion, turmoil, and harm actually. And so in the midst of that, the church has an opportunity and institutions have an opportunity to bring a message of health and healing and wholeness and all of that. We've got to turn this thing upside down one more time.
So I'm taking a note there. I'm actually typing that out. So pain, confusion, and turmoil are actually the fruit that are born out of the sexual confusion, the identity confusion, the identity theft that has taken place in our culture. And Christianity offers the actual, like, right, righteous, positive, joyful, liberating, healthy answer to all of that, and yet it is being characterized as precisely the opposite, as that which is harmful. I really don't think, Peter, there's a conversation that you and I could have that touches more deeply on what is happening in real people's lives right now.
Yeah, agreed. It is this, you know, I don't know what your growing up was like, but for me, there was questions about identity and insecurity always happening, of course, throughout those adolescent years. Junior high is such a terrible, difficult time of life for many, as is high school. But the options in which you might decide to untether yourself from the church and from your family and from some of these beautiful traditions of our faith, the options were relatively limited. You could decide if you wanted to maybe become a party kind of person on a Friday and Saturday night and untether in some of those sorts of ways. But what we've seen now over these last 10 years is that there are so many, and I would say more destructive ways to untether yourselves, and especially as some of the articles you and I were kicking around this week referenced, when you combine it with the breakdown of the family and the idea that the church is becoming less and less perceived to be relevant in young people's lives, that those two things, these historic institutions that held kids' identity and sense of self together, no longer exist, when you combine it with all of the sexual options on top of it, I think we just really don't quite understand how significant the turmoil is in our young people's lives. But this is then why we're seeing the rise of suicide rates, why we're seeing such extreme rises of anxiety and depression. Kids are not being held together any longer by those traditional institutions. And I'm not an alarmist by any stretch, but if somebody had an opportunity to read the papers that I get to read in my classes semester in and semester out, I sometimes feel like I'm the pterodactyl in the coal mine, just sort of shouting out, there is a crisis here. Our young people are dying because of this. And it's going to take more than just like a February week in church to help sort things out for our kids or a book to read or something like that. There's been a systematic, I would say, attack on institutions, as well as what fills the gap is actually bringing harm versus any kind of health.
Okay, I do want to touch on the numbers before we go. I was reading in the Wall Street Journal, I guess it was about 10 days ago now, an article entitled, Can Religion Still Speak to Younger Americans? And the American Family Survey data is what they were relying on there. And I just want people to know that when we talk about the rising influence of non-belief or non-affiliation in terms of the way young people identify, when we're talking about younger people in the culture, 44% of young Americans age 18 to 29, 44% of them have no faith, identify right. as having no faith. That is a dramatic increase. I mean, the culture at large is decreasing in terms of its committed affiliation with Christian institutions or the Christian faith, but it's rising the fastest among young people.
Right. Yeah, and I think we've spent a lot of time in our churches, at least what I see in seminaries and Christian ministry programs, identifying the word relevant with churches that are sort of attractive or make people feel comfortable, as if Sunday morning is it sort of looks like the rest of their life during the rest of the week. And it's usually is pretty seeker sensitive, and I understand the rationale for all of that, but I think relevance, Carmen, to me, is always the beautiful kingdom of Jesus, in which his teachings and the fact that his work on the cross and the empty tomb has set us free from the power of sin and death. And I would suggest to you that relevance is less about having this wonderful performance that streams through multiple campuses. And that can all be fine. I'm not saying derogatory things about that. But relevance really is about the truth of the kingdom setting us free from the power of sin and death to bring life and love and peace and hope that we begin to shine in the world around us and call people back in a reconciling way to God. And that's what our young people need, is to be anchored in that kind of beautiful story, as opposed to going and just simply being entertained by a service.
So I think that we'll walk off with these questions. If we have young people who say that the most significant reasons that they are disaffiliating from the Christian faith and Christian institutions is, number one, they question a lot of things that are being taught there, and number two, they don't really like the positions that those churches or institutions are taking on politics or social issues, maybe the questions we ought to be asking ourselves within Christian institutions and within our local church, are we actually offering answers? Are we preaching? Are we offering answers to questions they're not even asking?
Right.
And failing to hear the questions they are asking and then seek to address those together. So that's where I think we'll leave it. Peter, thank you so much, as always, for joining me. I feel like this is a conversation that we might need to continue to till.
I love it, Carmen.
We'll talk to you next time. That's Peter Kapsner. And you're listening to Mornings with Carmen. We'll be right back.